book of Judges, and we've come to chapter 12. Chapter 12 kind of finishes up the story of Jephthah. We dealt with most of his situation last time, but here in chapter 12, just as kind of an add-on to the end of Jephthah's judging, he had this run-in with the Ephraimites. And in verse 1 it says, "The men of Ephraim gathered together, crossed over towards Zaphon, and said to Jephthah, 'Why did you cross over to fight against the people of Ammon and didn't call us to go with you? We will burn your house down on you with fire.'" They were over on the east side of the Jordan River, and the Ammonites had created some problem, had been attacking them, and so they had gone and defeated the Ammonites, and the Ephraimites came across the Jordan and started hassling Jephthah and the other people from Israel, saying, "Why didn't you let us get in on this?" Now, the Ephraimites were, they apparently had this tendency. They didn't want to jump into the war when it was necessary, but afterwards they wanted to cash in on the booty. You remember back in chapter 8, they did the same thing with Gideon. After Gideon went and won the victory with 300 guys, then the Ephraimites came forward. They had never volunteered in the first place, but they pop up later and say, "Oh, we wanted to go too," and they were all mad at Gideon, and Gideon kind of placated them. But here it's getting more serious because they're attacking Jephthah and the other children of Israel who had won this victory over there on the Gilead side of the Jordan River. And so they just, you know, selfish is all it is. But Jephthah said, "My people and I were in a great struggle with the people of Ammon, and when I called you, you didn't deliver me out of their hands." So he had asked for help, and they hadn't given it to them. "So when I saw that you would not deliver me, I took my life in my hands and crossed over against the people of Ammon, and the Lord delivered them into my hand. Why then have you come up to me this day to fight against me?" So now Ephraim's going to get their due, and so they had been hassling all the people over there on the Gilead side, and so Jephthah gathered together all the men of Gilead and fought against Ephraim, and the men of Gilead defeated Ephraim because they said, "You Gileadites are fugitives of Ephraim among the Ephraimites and among the Manassites." So they were stirring up trouble. So between the Gileadites and the people who were with Jephthah, they were able to conquer the Ephraimites still while they were over there on the east side of the Jordan River. Well, as the Ephraimites tried to run back home, defeated, licking their wounds, it says that in verse 5, the Gileadites seized the fords of the Jordan before they arrived. So they stopped, they got at all the places where you'd be able to easily cross over, the shallow points, and if an Ephraimite tried to sneak across, they were such weasels that they didn't have the courage to say, "I'm from Ephraim." They go, "Oh, no, no, you know, I'm not an Ephraimite." And so what they would do is they would ask him, they said, "Are you an Ephraimite?" And if he said no, then they would say to him, "Then say Shibboleth." Ask him to say this word Shibboleth, which just meant stream. And Ephraimites couldn't pronounce it. They would say Sibboleth instead of Shibboleth. I guess they had an accent. It would, you know, in a different region of the country, they would have certain different ways of saying things. And so they used just this one word to ascertain whether someone was an Ephraimite or not. Say Shibboleth. Sibboleth. Sorry, you're an Ephraimite. Boom, you're dead. So, interesting little. I thought about, you know, there are all sorts of, you know, applications you can make of it and how sometimes just one word makes all the difference, but really it's just they just wanted to kill the Ephraimites because of what they did. So and then Jephthah judged Israel, and then after him Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon in the end of the chapter there. Each, it doesn't tell us much about them, but they judged for a period of time. Then we come to chapter 13, and this is where we have the story of Samson and his whole situation. And on Sunday, we talked about the end of his life and a little bit about going through his life. But we'll go through these passages again because it's a great story. It's an interesting passage of Scripture for sure. And so, as typical during the book of Judges, we find in verse 1 that the children of Israel were doing evil in the sight of the Lord again. And the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. The Philistines were people who, lived in Canaan over on the coast, primarily the southern part of Israel and down along the coast. They were the last, it was the last area for the most part that the children of Israel really conquered, and they never completely took the Philistines out. The Philistines ended up becoming their mortal enemies over a long period of time because they didn't. By the way, just a piece of trivia, the reason that Israel for a long time was called Palestine, when it was, well, when the British were in charge of it, and even today there are people who call it Palestine, it's an adaptation of the word Philistines, and it was really designed, that title Palestine was designed as an insult to the Jews, because they're basically saying it's Philistine country, and they were the ones that had hassled them for so many years. The people today who call themselves Palestinians, they sometimes claim that they're descendants of the Philistines. They aren't at all. They definitely aren't, you know, naturally, but they at least claim that as a heritage, nothing to brag about, but they're pretending like they were there all that time. They really weren't at all. The Philistines actually came from further west than that and had traversed down from up by Greece and worked their way down, and people who call themselves Palestinians today are mostly, they're Arabic from Jordan and Saudi Arabia and Iraq and all those countries around there. So the Philistines got a hold of them. And for 40 years, the Philistines were just running the show in Israel, were controlling them, harassing them, just making their lives miserable. And in the middle of that, after 40 years of that kind of misery, it says, a certain man from Zorah, of the family of Dan, the tribe of Dan, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had no children. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, indeed now you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Now therefore, please be careful not to drink wine or similar drink and not to eat anything unclean. Keep yourself away from anything that's unclean or from wine. For behold, you shall conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head. For the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. So the angel of the Lord, which we believe is an appearance of Jesus, the pre-incarnate Christ, or a Christophany, a theophany we sometimes call it. Jesus in the Old Testament appeared often to the people as the angel of the Lord, and he did at this point, and we'll see a little later why we know this is God who was actually appearing, but he came not to Manoah but to his wife and said, you need to really take care of yourself. I know you haven't had a kid. You'd like to. You really would love to bear a child. That hasn't happened for you. It's going to happen. But this child that you're going to have is someone really special. He is to be set apart as a Nazarite from his womb. Now, the Nazarite vows, we read about them over in Numbers chapter 6, but it was generally a temporary commitment, usually for a month, where someone would say, I am going to commit myself completely to the Lord for a period of time. If we were to do a Nazarite vow today, we would just say, I'm taking a sabbatical from everything that I'm doing, and I'm just going to really spend time with the Lord. Everything about me is going to be committed to Him. And while you were taking that Nazarite vow, you weren't to cut your hair. You weren't to go anywhere near grapes, wine, raisins, anything to do with the vineyard. You weren't to touch a dead body or defile yourself in any way. It was time set apart for God, dedicated to Him. And so it was not, in fact, this is the only instance we know of biblically where someone was to be a Nazarite for life. Now, by the way, a lot of people make the mistake and say that Jesus was a Nazarite. And I hear people say that, hear pastors say that quite often. There's nothing in the Bible that says that Jesus was a Nazarite. People make that confusion because he's called Jesus of Nazareth. Nazareth was a place. Nazarite is a word from Nazir, the same root word, but it means to separate. So Jesus, as far as we know, didn't take a Nazarite vow. Didn't need to. He was already set apart, not for just life, not for just a month, but for all of eternity. And so, but sometimes people confuse Nazareth and Nazarite, and they're two different things. So here she's told, you're going to have a special child, and he's to be a Nazarite. In fact, you need to purify yourself because he is within you and he's set apart even right now to do special things for the Lord. There's a hint that everything wasn't going to go completely well because it says there in verse 5, he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. They've been under the power of the Philistines for 40 years. You would hope that if somebody's going to deliver them, they would deliver them. With all the other judges, it generally worked out that way. But Samson, because of his weaknesses, because of some of his compromises and so on, he never completely got the job done. He did finally in his death get a lot done, but again, even from before he was born, the Lord knew he wasn't going to finish what he had started. Samson is this amazing picture of potential that's wasted for the most part. Someone who had all the ability, all the calling, all the heritage, godly parents, and a call from God, an appearance from Jesus to announce his birth, a miraculous conception where his mother had been barren, and yet with all that he had going for him and all the strength and all of the spiritual power that he possessed, never quite delivered on what he could have. And that's probably true of all of us, and we have a lot less going for us. But the woman came and told her husband, Manoah, and said, told him what happened. The angel, she said, a man of God came to me, and his countenance was like the countenance of the angel of God. He looked different. Very awesome, scary. But I did not ask him where he was from, and he did not tell me his name. And he said, behold, you're going to conceive and bear a son. Don't drink wine. Child shall be a Nazarite from the womb to the day of his death. Now, that's typical. She comes and tells her husband the story, and he's going, you didn't ask his name? You didn't where he's from? What's the deal? You didn't get all the information. Why didn't you ask questions? And so before he even questioned her, and thought, man, I wish I had been there. I would have said this or I would have done that. She goes, look, I don't know who he is. I didn't even ask his name. I don't know what's going on, but this is all he said. And so it says, Manoah goes, oh no, this sounds like something serious, and I can't leave this in the hands of my wife. I'm not just going to wait around and see what happens. And so Manoah prayed in verse 8. He prayed to the Lord and said, oh, my Lord, please let the man of God whom you sent come to us again and teach us what we shall do for the child who will be born. He realized, if this is true, and by the way, he didn't know probably that it was an angel of the Lord. He called him a man of God. He probably just thought it was some sort of prophet that came and talked. And so he's going, God, send him back. I have lots of questions. We need to, if this is really going to happen, I need to know more than just don't let the kid drink, you know, don't cut his hair. There's got to be more to it than that. I mean, what are we going to do? And so he's praying to God. How can we know how to be parents? And like most of us when we have kids, it starts to hit you. Oh, man, I have kids. I don't know what I'm doing. The even sadder thing is the people who've read a few books and taken a few classes and they think they really do know what they're doing when they become parents, and that's really laughable. But at least Manoah, you know, in his humility, he goes, I don't know what I'm doing. Come on, I need more information, God.
And it's interesting that God answered. He prayed, God listened to the voice of Manoah. And the angel of God came
to the woman again. You know, the guy's always off at work. When the angel of the Lord shows up, it's
frustrating. So God answers Manoah's prayer by showing up and talking to his wife again and said, look, then she ran to her husband. She's like, wait right here. And she runs to her husband and goes, the guy's back, come on.
And so the woman ran in haste, told her husband and said, look, the man who came to me the other day has just now appeared to me.
So Manoah got up, followed his wife, came to the man and said to him, are you the man who spoke to this woman? And he said, I am. Manoah said, now let your words come to pass. What will be the boy's rule of life and his work?
So Manoah says, you're the guy that said we're going to be having a baby. So let's take this from the top. Tell me about this kid. What's he going to be like? What's his life going to be like? What are we supposed to do? Do we have some... He's going to deliver Israel. He's going to be involved in saving us from the people that have lorded over us for 40 years. Come on, I need more information than that. Give me some details. And so
he said, of all that I said to the woman, let her be careful. The angel of the Lord just goes, you know, he's saying, what will be the boy's rule of life and his work? What kind of restrictions should we have on him? What sort of things is he going to do? And the angel goes, just listen to what I said. I told your wife, she had it right. Of all that I said, let her be careful, pay attention. She may not eat anything that comes from the vine, nor may she drink wine or similar drink, nor eat anything unclean. All that I commanded her, let her observe.
So he says, you got the whole story. Now, this is so typical of when God speaks to us sometimes, because we would love it if God would just light up the trail ahead of us. If he would just say, let me give you all the answers to your questions. Let me draw the future so that you can see it in great detail. And quite often, he doesn't do that for us. In fact, I don't think he ever does that for us. Instead, he says, look, you do what I've told you to do, and don't worry. The other stuff, it's going to happen. I know myself as I look into the future, and I know as a leader, as a pastor, I'm kind of expected to know what to expect. And sometimes we just don't. We just have to say, well, let's see. Let's see what happens. We need to be faithful at what God has told us and know that he's still going to be there in the future. He doesn't. See, if God would say, here's your next 10 years, you need to do this, 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 this. You need this rule, this rule, this rule, this procedure, this capability. You need to work on this. This is going to happen. And if he spelled it out for us, you know what our tendency would be, probably, would be to go, okay, great, we're covered. Thanks, God. I'll see you in another 10 years. We'll talk to you later when all that you've given us has kind of run out. And so God knows we need to rely on him. That's the main thing. See, the deal with Samson was not don't cut his hair and don't let him drink. That wasn't it. It was he's a Nazarite, consecrate him to the Lord. It's not about his hair. It's not about his habits. It's about his commitment, his consecration. And so God's saying, look, that's it. All I'm telling you is consecrate him to the Lord. I know it gets really frustrating to people when, especially kids as they get into college, if maybe they don't know what they want to be when they grow up. It just seems like, you know, I don't have an idea. When you're a little kid, you know, well, I'm going to be a cop, a fireman, or whatever. And it's you're usually pretty sure, but then you start to realize it's not what you thought it was going to be. And you go, what do I do now? What am I supposed to do? There are some of us that never completely outgrow that. I know people who are in their 60s that are still trying to figure out what they're going to be when they grow up. It's frustrating, but that's the way God is. He has a tendency to say, you know what? Do what I'm already telling you to do, and then you'll see what's going to happen down the road. What's amazing to me is how many times we all get sucked into this tendency to say, you know, if you don't tell me what's going to happen next month, then I'm not going to play right now. If I don't know how this is going to turn out, then count me out now. I want to know the ending. It's almost like when you watch a sporting event that has been recorded on TV, and you go, okay, like the Lakers are playing tonight. They're on TV right now. So you go, you know, I can't stand to see the Lakers lose. So what I'm going to do when I get home, I'm going to fast forward to the end of the game and see if they win. If they win, I'll watch it. If they lose, I'm not going to watch it. But it kind of defeats the whole purpose of a game. If you already know they're going to win, what do you want to watch that for? If you already know they're going to lose, okay. But it's the not knowing that makes life interesting sometimes, and God knows that as well. But we need to make sure that we don't fall into kind of what Manoah was sort of feeling here was, look, give me more information. God kind of said, look, all you need to know is you're going to have a baby. He's going to be really special. And you consecrate him to the Lord. And you keep yourselves pure. And you make yourselves ready. And you'll see when the time comes, it's going to happen. I'll be in control. I'll be there. I'm not leaving. I'll be available to you. You prayed to me. I showed up. I'll show up again. But don't worry too much about what's going on down the road. Here's the thing. The truth is, it's like
premarital counseling. I remember when I was in seminary and I took a lot of counseling classes and things like that. I mean, I had premarital counseling. It was hours and hours and hours. And I would run people through the Taylor Johnson temperament analysis test. And I would go through all of this stuff. And, you know, I never found that it really did that much, honestly, to make people's marriages successful. Because the truth is, before you're married, you don't even believe that you're going to need all that stuff. You think it doesn't apply to you. You think that you're the exception, that you and your spouse, you and your fiance, you guys really know each other so well that you're not going to have any problems. Nothing difficult is ever going to happen. No hurdles, no fights, no struggles. No, we're just not like that. It's amazing. We just never fight. We don't. And so somebody can teach you all they want about what marriage is like. But I've always found sometimes it's best just to go, okay. I certainly, in premarital, I like to talk about the scriptures and things like that. But I've realized you can't prepare someone for marriage. They get married, and then they realize how desperate they are. And then they come, and then they really pay attention. Then they go, what do we do now? Norm Wright, who was one of my professors in seminary, wrote a premarital book called Before You Say I Do. But he said he realized that people didn't, you know, later on when they got married, they said, man, I wish I had paid attention to it then, but I didn't. And so he took the same book and he just changed the words and changed fiance to spouse, and he called the book After You Say I Do. And a lot of times that's the way it is. You know, you too much information will either intimidate you or frighten you or bum you out or get you overly confident. One way or the other, if God lighted up the future for you, it probably wouldn't be in your best interest. So again, he just says, Manoah, just do what I told you to do. You're going to have a baby, consecrate him to me. That's the important thing. That's the real thing. Now, you also wonder, why such a big deal about wine? And we have, and I don't want to go into a long thing on wine, or we just won't get through the chapters I hope to cover tonight. But it's interesting how often in the scriptures, alcoholic beverages are used in some way connected to spirituality. Now, I'm not, you know, on a soapbox to just say that anyone who drinks alcoholic beverages is in sin. But I would encourage you to just pray about, why is it that, for instance, elders and deacons aren't supposed to do that? Why is it that a Nazirite was supposed to stay away from alcoholic drinks? And I'm not trying to take your liberty away from you or anything, but to me, scripturally, it's tied in, alcohol is tied in so often with spirituality. And then you have, I will just read one passage to you in Proverbs chapter 23. There are lots of others, but Proverbs 23, talking about alcoholic drinks and their effects on you, says this. He says, actually the whole chapter talks about it some, but yeah, especially in verse 29, who has woe, who has sorrow, who has contentions, who has complaints, who has wounds without cause, who has redness of eyes, those who linger long at the wine, those who go in search of mixed wine. Don't look on the wine when it's red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it swirls around smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things and your heart will utter perverse things. Yes, you will be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, or like one who lies at the top of the mast, saying, they have struck me, but I was not hurt. They have beaten me, but I did not feel it. When shall I awake that I may seek another drink? Of course, over in Proverbs 31, also speaking to the king, it says, 31 verse 4, it's not for kings, O Lemuel, another name for Solomon, it's not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drinks, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the justice of all the afflicted, and so on. Scripture, there are a whole lot of places that talk about alcoholic drinks in this way, and it's something that is definitely connected to spirituality. And if you want to say, but can I have permission to have a glass of wine once in a while? Whatever, you can do what you want. But the idea shouldn't be, what are we allowed to do? The idea should be, is there a compelling reason to do something that in the Bible is set off as opposed to a true commitment to the Lord. If it's a spiritual thing in any way, if it's connected, of course, you know, in Ephesians, Paul said, don't be drunk with wine wherein is excess, but be filled with the Spirit. If it is in any way, and you go, well, you know, it only says don't be drunk with wine. It doesn't say don't drink wine. But again, if it's set off as opposed to being filled with the Spirit, how many drinks makes you drunk enough that it's affecting how much you're filled with the Spirit? I've been in a lot of tests through the police academy and different things where they let people have a drink and you test your driving ability, you test your reaction time and things like that. And one drink affects you to some degree. And if in fact that's the case, then do you want to be more filled with the Spirit? Do you want to be less filled with the Spirit? But anyway, that's my little spiel on alcohol. I don't go off on it very often, but I know for me, I don't drink at all. If I were to have a drink of wine at dinner, would it be a sin? You know, probably not, although the Bible says whatsoever is not of faith is sin, and I have a tendency to think I might feel a little creepy about it. I haven't always felt that way, by the way. I haven't always thought that for me, I shouldn't do it. Actually, when I kind of, I'm taking too much time on this, but when I finally really understood that for me, this was just something to be completely avoided was a friend of mine, Bob Lang, who goes to church here, and he was a teacher at Calvary Costa Mesa for many years, but he had run the alcohol ministry there, and he had been a drunk for a long time, and he had just been sober for a year or so when I met him. But when he became a Christian, he realized he had to quit drinking. He was the kind of guy who would go on binges for months and months, lived at the rescue mission, taught in the public schools at the same time, by the way. But Bob was, when he became a Christian, he started going to Calvary, and he told me that one time he was new there, and some people reached out to him, and hey, you know, let's go out to lunch. And they took him out to lunch, and they had a glass of wine with dinner. And he didn't want to tell them I'm an alcoholic. And he just thought, well, guy, they're really spiritual people. They're having a glass of wine. I think I'll have a glass of wine too. And it sent him on like a six-month binge. And he said, Bob said to me years ago, he said, Dave, you don't know who's an alcoholic. You may not have a problem with it. And you may say, well, I just do it in the privacy of my own home. Well, do you ever have people over to your house? Do your kids see you? Do they pay attention to what's going on? How do you know? How do you know who you're going to affect? And so after thinking about that a while, I just decided I won't drink anymore. And I, you know, there are times at a wedding when you get a glass and to toast and you think it's Martin. Oh, you know, it's not. Or at communion somewhere or something. I'm not paranoid about it. But at the same time, it just makes good sense that this is something that the Bible indicates that we really need to be careful of, and it's a good thing to stay away from it. You won't find anything other than the medicinal use where Paul told Timothy, take a little wine for your stomach's sake. You don't have the scriptures telling a lot of spiritual things that happen as a result of drinking, so I'll get off my soapbox. Notice, though, that it was also... Okay, I'll get back. I was just going to say, the mom was to be the example as well. I've had kids that I've disciplined at school for drinking, and their parents come in all mad at them, and then they go, where did you get the alcohol? Well, in your liquor cabinet. Duh. So then, anyway, Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, please, let's detain you. Can you hang around a little bit? He's thinking maybe we'll get some more information out of him if I can loosen him up with a meal. He says, let me cook a young goat for you. And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, I'll hang around, but I'm not going to eat your food. But if you offer a burnt offering, you must offer it to the Lord. For Manoah did not know that he was the angel of the Lord. Now, you can read that and think that it almost sounds like the angel of the Lord is saying, I'm not God. Offer the sacrifice to God instead. As we read on, you find out definitely that's not the case with what happens. He's in the middle of the sacrifice. But what he's saying is, you think I'm just a guy. I'm not going to sit here and eat a meal with you like I'm just a guy. You need to understand who you're dealing with, and you need to offer this food as a sacrifice. Now, contrast that with when the angel of the Lord came to Abraham, to Abram at that time, and he sat and ate with him. It's not that God couldn't do it. It's that he wanted to make the point to Manoah, there's a difference. I'm not just someone who's talking. I'm not just a great man. I'm not just a prophet. I'm God, and this is how you need to relate to me. It's interesting too, though, Abraham, as being the only one who just sat there and ate with them until Jesus came along, was also the only one in the scriptures that was called the friend of God in the Old Testament. But Manoah wasn't quite there. And so then Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, "What's your name, that when your words come to pass, we may honor you?" He's still not totally sure that this is legit. He's going, "But what's your name so that when this happens, hey, we'll give you the credit." Still doesn't understand who he is. And the angel of the Lord said to him, "Why do you ask my name, seeing it is wonderful?" My name is unbelievable. It's a wonder. It's puzzling. If I told you, I don't think you'd understand it anyway. My name is wonderful. I like the old song that said, "His name is wonderful." It's true. In the strongest sense of the word, wonderful and wonder, that's who God's name is. Notice he says here, it's wonderful. Fast forward to Isaiah's prophecy in chapter 9, verse 6. "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful." And so he says, all you need to know is it's wonderful. So Manoah took the goat and the grain offering and offered it upon the rock to the Lord, notice. And he did a wondrous thing. The angel of the Lord did something that he just couldn't describe, something wonderful, while Manoah and his wife looked on. Probably started shining, glowing, morphing, I don't know, something that was just like, whoa, look at that. Probably kind of like what he did on the Mount of Transfiguration when he was just transformed, transfigured in that way. And it happened as the flame went up toward heaven from the altar. The angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the altar. Man, he's doing this glowing, weird, kind of spooky thing as they're burning the sacrifice. And then he goes right into the flame. And he disappears up into the sky in the midst of the flame, in the midst of the sacrifice. And the angel of the Lord, Jesus Christ, he is the one who all sacrifice, it's about him. It's true. When we look at, like, when you watch the movie about Jesus' sacrifice, we need to remind ourselves constantly that that's it. All that the Bible has to say about sacrifice, it's right there in Jesus Christ. That's what it means. That's what it's all about. This Sunday, we're going to celebrate communion and talk about his sacrifice a little bit more. But it's just a wonderful reminder of the fact that Jesus, the angel of the Lord, the angel of Jehovah, there he is right in the middle of that. In the same way that with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, as they were offered supposedly as a sacrifice, yet the angel of the Lord was there in the middle of the flames with them. And so, poof, he's gone. And it says that Manoah and his wife saw it. They fell on their faces to the ground. Oh, man. And the angel of the Lord appeared no more to Manoah and his wife. Then Manoah knew that he was the angel of the Lord. He didn't come walking out from behind a bush or something and go, "Hey, what'd you think of that?" He's like, he went up in the sacrifice and he was gone. And they go, "Man, he was the angel of the Lord." And Manoah said to his wife, "We shall surely die because we have seen God." They understood the angel of the Lord was God. Some people today don't understand it, but they knew it. It was obvious. And they also fell prey to this idea that if you saw God, that it would kill you. And it goes back to their stories of when Moses got the law and all these things happened, and then other times when, you know, the two priests made the, you know, did the incorrect sacrifice in some time when they were drunk, and Hophni and Phinehas, and poof, they were burned up. And so the children of Israel had got the idea wrongfully that if you see God, you're dead. Now, no one can see the Father. No one can see the Father. When God wants to reveal himself, he reveals himself through his Son. Reveals himself through the angel of the Lord, through Jesus Christ himself. Sadly, when people see how amazing God is, they sometimes want to push away from him. They sometimes want to go, "Oh no, I can't look, I can't see him." The children of Israel, after they heard God's voice at Mount Sinai, they got together and said, "You know what? From now on, God, it's nice hearing your voice and everything, but it'd be better if you would just talk to Moses and let him talk to us. We don't want to get too close." And it's the same thing today. There are a lot of people who just feel like God is someone to be feared. But it's not it at all. He was coming to reveal himself. He wants to deliver the people of God. And so, but they thought, oh, we're dead. And his wife said, if the Lord had desired to kill us, though, he wouldn't have accepted the burnt offering and grain offering from our hands, and he wouldn't have told us all this stuff and, you know, everything that's going to happen. And so she figured, I guess we're not going to die. And so the woman bore a son and called his name Samson. The name Samson meant sunshine or brightness. As we get to know Samson, we understand that if he was named Brightness, I don't know, he wasn't very bright, he seemed like, but sunshine, I don't know. He's probably named after that wonderful sight that they saw while the angel of the Lord is disappearing in the fire. So they called him Sunny Samson. And the child grew, and the Lord blessed him, and the Spirit of the Lord began to move upon him at Mahanadan between Zor and Eshtaol, there in the neighborhood where they lived. Probably means that he was demonstrating at a young age some feats of supernatural strength. In some way, they were going, whoa, Spirit of God is on him. Amazing things are starting to happen, even as he's a young kid, to see that God had a special hold on his life. Chapter 14 brings us to the story of Samson with the woman of Timnah. We don't have her name, but this was a Philistine woman that Samson saw her, and he liked her. They lived only a few miles from where his family lived, and so it says that he saw her and went up and told his father and mother and said, I've seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, therefore, get her for me as a wife. Now, this wasn't strictly prohibited by Jewish law. When they came into the land, they were told six different Canaanite civilizations that they weren't to intermarry with. The Philistines weren't one of them. So technically, probably wasn't a violation of what God had said. But by the spirit of the law, they should have understood these Philistines who have taken over our whole land. This can't be a good thing, really, to marry them, you'd think. But his father and mother said, come on, aren't there some people around here in Dan that you could marry? Don't go get a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines. And Samson said to his father, get her for me, for she pleases me well. Literally, where it says she pleases me well, it says literally, she is right in my eyes. Remember, the end of the book of Judges says this was a period of time when everybody did what was right in their own eyes. So he says, no, I like her, I want her, get her for me. And Samson may have been big enough at this point that, you know, we don't know. It doesn't say, by the way, that he's this big, ripped guy, but at this point, his parents were pretty much doing what he told them to do. And so, but also this interesting verse 4, but his father and mother didn't know that it was of the Lord, that he was seeking an occasion, that is, God was, to move against the Philistines, for at that time the Philistines had dominion over Israel. So here, Samson's looking at her and just going, I like this chick. In the flesh, she's attractive to me, she's what I'm looking for, and I want her. And yet, his parents didn't realize that God also, as he so often, as he always does, he causes everything to work together for good. So even Samson wanting to do a wrong thing, God's going, okay, you mean it for evil, but I mean it for good. As Joseph told his brothers after he was sold into slavery in Egypt, God says, this'll work. I want to defeat the Philistines. What better way to defeat them than to have Samson marry into one of their families? And so God's going, this is fine. And he's the same way with us, by the way. Whatever we do, he says, don't worry, I'll work this out. I'll make it work. That's what God's sovereignty is all about. Not that he forced us to do like a chess man. It's that he can work everything together for good. So once you think of a stupid thing to do, he figures out a way where sin abounds, that grace can much more abound. He's great that way. I love the way God does that. I've given the example before of Jonah. He thought he was running away from God. He was just transferring his transportation from a boat to a whale. He still ended up in Nineveh, and we will too. And so Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother and came to the vineyards of Timnah. Now, he should have never been in a vineyard, by the way. As a Nazarite, he's not supposed to be anywhere close to vineyards. But a young lion came out and surprised him. Now, he was walking away from his parents because his parents didn't witness this. It's a good thing. They would have freaked. But he probably said, hey, I'll catch up to you, and took a detour through the vineyards of Timnah. And he ends up, the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and he ripped the lion apart. as like it was, he didn't even have anything in his hand. He just ripped it to shreds and didn't even mention it to his parents. This lets you know the kind of guy he was. I mean, if I ever, there have been times when I am out hiking or something and I kill a rattlesnake. I can't wait to tell people what I did. He's got a lion jumping on him and he's like rips him apart with his bare hands and then just like parents go, oh, hey, how's everything? Oh, everything's fine. Anything happened today interesting? No, not really. Doesn't even bother mentioning it. I like that. And so he went down and he talked to the woman in verse 7. Probably, they didn't talk back and forth. Families arranged the marriages. And so this phrase that he talked to the woman is probably a reference to the fact that they became betrothed. They became engaged at this point. And she pleased Samson well. He like closed the deal. It's great. Yeah, we'll get married. Sounds good. And after some time, verse 8, probably a year, usually what they would do is they would become betrothed. And then a year later, they would actually consummate the marriage and have the ceremony and all that. So after some time, when he returned to get her, while he was walking there, he remembered the lion. And he just thought, hey, I wonder if the bones are still there. And so after a long period of time, it's all dried out. And he went there, and a swarm of bees were in the cavity of the lion and honey in there. So he reaches in, gets some honey, then catches up to his parents and goes, hey, you want some honey? Doesn't tell them where the honey came from, just interesting thing. Now, there are people who have suggested that this is ridiculous because bees would not ever form a hive inside a dead animal. But actually, they've found that it has happened. It's just the animal has to be there long enough to get dried out, picked apart, so it's just bones. And they've found examples of this. So that's what happened. And it comes in later with his little riddle. So they ate. He didn't tell them where he got it. And they came down to the woman. And so his dad was closing the deal with her dad. And Samson gave a feast for young men used to do so. In that area, they would take like a week to have a wedding reception, basically, and invite all your friends. And he didn't have a bunch of friends in that area, so they brought 30 companions to be with him, Philistine guys that he didn't really know. And then in verse 12, Samson posed a riddle. This was pretty common in those days, and still in areas of the East it is, where at a party as entertainment, the guy who's putting on the party would ask a riddle, and everyone in the party would try to solve the riddle. Generally, the way it usually went, and like especially the Romans were big on this, if you solved the riddle, you'd get a glass of wine or something like that that would be a reward to you at the banquet. Of course, he wasn't supposed to drink wine. If you didn't get it after a certain period of time, then you had to drink salt water. And so it's just a little game that they played. But the stakes were quite a bit more here because he said, I've got a riddle, and if you can explain it and you have 7 days to do so, I'll give you guys 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes, 30 new outfits, one for each of you. But if you can't do it, then you need to give me 30 outfits. And so they said, okay, what's your riddle? And he said to them, out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet. So he's talking about the lion, obviously. Nobody knew that he had killed the lion. How would you even imagine that honey would be in the middle of a lion? So he thought this was a pretty good riddle. And so it says for 3 days they couldn't explain the riddle. But on the seventh day, they came to Samson's wife, and they said, entice your husband that he may explain the riddle to us, or else we'll burn you and your father's house with fire.
Gee, I mean, they were pretty serious about it. This is over 30 outfits.
Have you invited us in order to take what is ours? Is that not so?
I mean, these guys were some friends, really serious. This is their own relatives that they're saying this to.
Then Samson's wife wept on him and said, you only hate me. You don't love me. You've posed a riddle to the sons of my people, but you haven't even explained it to me. And he said to her, look, I haven't explained it to my own mom and dad. Why should I explain it to you? He's probably not ready for marriage, let's face it. But now she had wept on him the 7 days while their feast lasted, and it happened on the seventh day that he told her, because she pressed him so much. Then she explained the riddle to the sons of her people. Now, there's some question about it says that
they tried to solve the riddle for 3 days. The banquet was for 7 days. They came to her on the seventh day in order to threaten her to get the answer to the riddle. But it says that she wept on him about trying to get the answer for 7 days. So there are some people who have a problem with that, and they've tweaked it, saying, well, maybe it was the third day of the banquet, but it was the Sabbath, and so that made it the seventh day, but it still doesn't explain why she wept for 7 days. I think the simplest explanation, and the most obvious one to me, is that the banquet lasted for 7 days. On the first day, he gives the riddle. They tried to solve it for 3 days. They finally just kind of gave up and forgot about it for the rest of the banquet. For a couple days, they were just having a good time at the party, forgot about the riddle. Now, the woman of Timnah, his wife, for the whole 7 days is bugging him because she wants to know what the riddle actually is. And he won't tell her, and it's not that big of a deal. But on the seventh day, she gets pressured, you know, with her life and her family's lives. And so now she really cranks on the tears. She had been wearing them down for 7 days, but on the seventh day, she goes and really gives her big sales pitch. And so he ends up telling her what the deal is. So I hope that's clear. Now, after that happened, they came in and they go, he said, did you solve the riddle or do you have my clothes? And they said, well, what's sweeter than honey and what's stronger than a lion? Like, how would they have ever figured that out? And so he knew, and he said to them, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle. Now, this marriage is getting off on the wrong foot, definitely. You know, this is still at the reception, and he's saying, you plowed with my heifer. But he's mad. Amazingly, then the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily. Because remember, God, he didn't even care what Samson's motive was as much. He's going, I'm going to use this guy. So he gets mad about this thing. And so God goes, okay, we're going to kill some Philistines. And so he went and killed 30 of them. 30 of these guys' relatives took their clothes off and gave the clothes to them. And his anger was aroused and he went back to his father's house. So Samson goes, you want clothes? I'll give you clothes. And he goes out and he gets 30 of their buddies. He kills them all, brings in 30 sets of clothes, probably blood all over them and everything, throws them down, goes, there's your outfits. How do you like that? And then he's like, I am not in the mood to be married right now. And he ends up, he just goes back to his father's house. Now, you think that's kind of a weird thing to do right after you got married. But realizing what this was like, it was almost an annulment in a way, is probably the way they look. Kind of like Britney Spears, you know, 8-hour wedding in Las Vegas or something. He's like, man, this happens at the reception. I can't wait to see what comes next. And so he's just like, that's it. But, you know, when we get burned, when we find ourselves conned by the enemy, when we realize, what have I been thinking? I got sucked into some really dumb thinking. I've done something that's really wrong. That's not a bad time to go back to the Father's house. That's not a bad time to go back to square one, where you started from, where you first were with the Lord, and go, okay, God, I need you to heal me. I need you to touch me. I want to go back to square one. And so that's really what he did. And, you know, in the meantime, they had the cake and everything. And so they just said, why don't you just marry the best man? So she did. And in chapter 15, after a while, Samson starts thinking about this girl and having second thoughts. He's, you know, it's like he's away from her. He's not listening to her, nagging him and everything. And he's looking at his wedding pictures and just going, you know, she was kind of nice. And it was wheat harvest. And so he went and visited his wife with a young goat. A young goat would have been a major delicacy in those times. So he's thinking, maybe we can get back together. Maybe this will still work out. And so he comes with the goat and said, you know, let me go in the bedroom and talk to my wife. And her dad said, no, you don't want to do that. I thought you hated her, and so she married your best man. But look, she's got a younger sister, cuter than she is. Why don't you just take her? But this was a real insult to a guy who said, no, this is, I mean, how many of you would be satisfied if you wanted to marry who you married, but instead, well, you remember the story you know, what happened to Jacob when that happened. You don't want to just marry anybody. I mean, you'd perish the thought that you'd pick one and they'd go, well, look, her sister looks pretty much like her. Why don't you take her instead? So he isn't going for this at all. And Samson said, okay, that's it.
this time I'm going to be blameless regarding the Philistines if I hurt them. So he went and caught 300 foxes.
Now, they probably weren't foxes. The Hebrew word here usually refers to a jackal. The difference is foxes have a tendency to hang out by themselves, and it would have taken a long time to catch 300 of them. But jackals run in a herd, and you could kind of herd them and catch them that way, and he probably had help anyway. But he got 300 of these animals, and he tied torches tail to tail, put torches between a pair of jackals, and so then lit the torches and let them run through the wheat fields. Now remember in verse 1 it said it was at the time of wheat harvest, which would have been a very, very dry period of time. And the fields being ready to be harvested were also easily burned. And of course that's a bad time to burn a crop too, right, when you're ready to pick it. But the foxes ran through and burned out all the grain of the Philistines and all the standing grain. And then they went crazy, got in the vineyards, the olive groves, everything. It was just a devastation with these 300 foxes. And by the way, later on in Roman days, they would do this same thing in the Colosseum as sport, tie these animals together with a flame between them and watch them run around and go crazy. So I don't think PETA approves of it, but it's what happened. And the Philistines said, "Who did this?" And everybody goes, "Oh, it was Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite." Now it's like, yeah, he's married to her. So they said, that's it. And they came up and burned her and her father with fire. Hard to feel too sorry for them, but, Samson got mad about that too. And he said, "You do something like this, I'm going to take revenge on you, and after that I'll cease. Look, I'm just going to do something to you one more time, and then I'll be okay. I'm just going to get this out of my system. I'm not going to get carried away, but I'm going to kill some people. Then you guys need to back off, okay?" And so he attacked them, hip and thigh. That's just an expression to mean, boy, he was just beating the tar out of them, with a great slaughter. And then he went down and dwelt in the cleft of the rock of Edom. So he whipped up on them bad, till he felt better, or until he was just tired of throwing punches. And then he went and just went to pout in the little cave there. And the Philistines came up. They wanted to go after him. They're going, "Man, this guy's killing our people. We haven't had enough." They should have thought, "Let's just leave well enough alone." But they wanted to go up after him. And they came to the men in Judah and they go, "Where is this Samson guy?" And they said, "Oh, he's up in the cave. I don't know if you want to go up there or not." And so as you read through this passage, finally, a bunch of the men of Judah, 3,000 of them, went up and go, "Samson? Knock, knock, knock. What? Well, we're supposed to arrest you. I don't know if, is that okay?" It's kind of like, I used to know this guy who, a Samoan guy who would just, he was the nicest, sweetest guy. But he'd get angry or somebody would cross him and he would just go berserk. It was scary. I faced him a couple times and I was like, "Whoa, somebody else is driving." And it was, but when the police would arrest him, he used to get arrested a lot because he'd get into skirmishes. He's settled down since, but back when he was younger, big, huge, strong guy, couldn't even wear shoes because shoes wouldn't fit on his feet. Well, this guy, when the police would arrest him every weekend, he didn't like to be handcuffed. And so they would come up to him and they would hand him the handcuffs and he would handcuff himself and then he was okay. So that's kind of what they did here. They go, "Samson, we got some ropes here." And Samson goes, "Okay, you can tie me up, but you're not going to kill me, right?" And they go, no, we're not going to kill you." And so they brought him down to the Philistines. And when the Philistines saw him, they jumped on him. And he busted the ropes like they were rubber bands.
And he picked up the jawbone of a donkey and just a little bone, stuck it in his hand, probably like you'd use brass knuckles, and he starts swinging on these Philistines, and he's just punching them all out and devastating them. And it says that he killed 1,000 men with just his hand with a bone in it, not some big, huge baseball bat kind of bone, just the kind of bone that would fit in your hand, a jawbone. And so then he wrote a poem. It's kind of nice. This is 1,000 dead guys around, and he's like, "With the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, I have slain 1,000 men." Oh, cool, good,
And after he was did that, he was tired. He threw the jawbone away, and he named the place, you know, Jawbone Heights, and Ramoth-Lehi. And then he got thirsty, and he cried out to the Lord. By the way, the only other time he prays that we know of in his life is at the end, as we looked at Sunday, when he asked God to bring the house down on him. But here he prays, and the Lord actually opened up a piece of the rock, and water came out, and he drank, and his spirit returned, and he revived. And then he named that place En Hakkor, which means the spring of the one who requests or supplicates, the one who prays. And so he named it, and they still said they know where that place is when this was written. And he judged Israel for 20 years in the days of the Philistines. Now we come to chapter 16, the whole story of Delilah. You remember the story, and we talked about it a lot Sunday, so we won't read the whole thing. But basically, he goes to Gaza, and there's a prostitute there, and he's with her, and they try to arrest him, and he ends up grabbing the gates of the city and carrying them up to the top of the hill. Just a childish prank kind of a thing with these gates. But after that, he met Delilah, and he loved her. And so he goes with her, and the Philistines were saying to Delilah, you got to find out what is the secret of his strength. Why is it? How does he do the things that he does? Now, this is one reason why I'm not completely convinced that Samson looked like what you see in the pictures of him. See, if a guy is like huge and ripped and just massive, you don't say, what's the secret of his strength? You look at him and you go, of course, the secret of his strength, he's huge. And it could be that Samson just looked like a regular guy. They kept thinking they could take him. So, I mean, maybe he was just this little skinny guy, and they're going, how does this happen? A little hippie. I mean, he's got the long hair. He's got, and yet he has this ability. And so they're saying, you got to find out. So she starts nagging him, and he says, oh, you know, bind me with brand new ropes, and I'll be like everybody else. He wakes up. He's tied up with new ropes, and he goes, ha, 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 you know, breaks them off, beats up some Philistines. And then she goes, you lied to me. And so then he says, well, you know, okay, I'll tell you. What it really is the ropes have to be weaved together. And so then he wakes up and he's got those ropes on. He still doesn't get it. Again, a guy that's named Brightness, he didn't seem to be very bright. Again, breaks them off. Then he says, if my hair is weaved together in a loom, then I'll be like everyone else. He's getting closer to the truth. And he wakes up and this loom is in his hair. He's got, you know, half of a dreadlock haircut, and he jumps up and beats these guys up. Now, at some point, I would think I would say to Delilah, you know, you've done this enough times. We're not going to talk about it anymore. I've had it with you. I can find somebody else. It's amazing, though, how people will stay in a relationship that's almost this stupid. How many people just continue to take it? They're dating somebody and they think, man, this person treats me like dirt, but I think if we get married, it's going to be different. Yeah, it's going to be different. It's going to be a lot worse. And so here he is. He still thinks that they have something going. He thinks maybe we have a future. And so they're not married. She's trying to get him killed. He knows that. And yet still, he gives into that nagging and says, okay, the deal is, cut my hair, I'll be weak. I'll be like everyone else. I'll be like any other man. He wakes up, you know, with a crew cut. And sadly, it says that he thought he'd get up like every other time. See, at this point, Samson was so deluded that he didn't understand that at some point, he's going to break his covenant to the Lord and God wouldn't give him that strength anymore. He was banking that he'd always be able to do what he had done before. Now, was it his hair? Is that the secret to his strength? No, it was his commitment to the Lord. But when he finally went that far to say, my Nazarite vow doesn't mean a thing to me, he had failed before consistently, but finally he got to this point, and he completely gave up on his commitment to the Lord in every way. He wanted this woman more than he wanted God. And so at this point, he was like everyone else. And they took him and they shackled him. After having cut his hair, and they poked his eyes out. And you know the story. We talked about it Sunday. He stood there in this banquet of Philistines,
performing for them, entertaining them. His hair, though, had started to grow. And finally, after this period of time, he cries out to God with an imperfect prayer, avenge now mine eyes. And yet, at the same time, at least he was calling out to God. And he was willing to be used by God to destroy these godless people. And so God allowed him once more for the Spirit to come upon him, his strength to come back. He made his way with the help of a kid to grabbing the two pillars of the house. Now, there are some of these amphitheater-like buildings still around today. And the way they build them is you have a ground floor, and then there's a wooden patio that goes around the top. It's kind of like a roof, but it slants out, and people can sit there like spectators. And all of the weight goes down on these two pillars. Plus, there's one big beam in between the two pillars. And so if you'd study physics or engineering, you could explain it better than I can. But all the weight of this thing is able to be basically supported by two pillars and one beam. And so he got a hold of those pillars, pushed the pillars out away from those beams. The beam would have fallen. The roof would have fallen in. Everyone in it, all of the weight of that would have crushed everyone in the building. And that's what happened finally. And finally, he really does some good. He delivered Israel as he was told to do. He sadly didn't get to see it. Often God will use us in different times and different ways. And if we don't stay committed to him, we end up being destroyed by our own foolishness, our own inability to submit to God. And though God will use us, he could have used us so much more, and we could have been there to enjoy it. We didn't have to be the bad example. We didn't have to be the ones who everyone goes, yeah, you know, you don't want to do what he does. You don't want to do what this guy did. And become kind of a byword, as Samson rather is for us today. He was buried, his brother and his fathers came and got his body, and his father and his brothers came and picked up his body and went and buried him. And that's the it. Altogether, 20 years he judged Israel. He delivered them and was their leader, and they looked up to him, and I'm sure he was popular in a lot of ways, and we still love to think of the stories of what he must have been able to do with all of his strength. And we have to look at the end and the final analysis and say, what could have been? What might have happened? You might have heard the story about the guy who said that he had a dream where he went to heaven. You've heard that story, of course. It's the start of like 100 different stories. But he was led to a room, and the room had his name on it. And the angel opened the door, and inside the room it was just packed full of presents and gifts. And he said, wow, is this all the stuff you're giving me now that I'm in heaven? And the angel said, no, this is all the stuff that God wanted to give you. It was all wrapped and ready, but because you wouldn't go along with it, you wouldn't submit to him, you wouldn't pray and ask him, you missed all of these opportunities, you missed all of these gifts. And I think, you know, if we would focus our attention on, as it was told in the beginning to him, just say, you know what your job is? It's not to fix the world. It's not to tell other people what they ought to be doing. It's not to judge others. It's not. Your job is you be consecrated to God. If everyone around you seems like they're messed up, you be consecrated completely to God. You dedicate yourself to him 100%. And when you do that, you'll find out you have abilities and skills and talents and gifts that you would have never guessed. And you'd be able to use them. But we become distracted. We become drawn away by our flesh, by the things that the world has to offer, by things like our own anger, the works of the flesh, that end up ripping us off. And not only does it rip us off, but it rips off everyone else around that God intends for us to minister to. It makes me sad to think of times when God gave me a perfect chance to make a difference in someone's life, but then I got mad at them, and then they did something dumb, and I missed that opportunity. And the opportunity didn't come back. I think of people, and often this happens to me, and you know, sometimes when, and as you get older, you learn from it, but I've lost people. They've died suddenly, unexpectedly. And then coming back into my head is the last time I talked to them, we weren't on good terms. I think I came across kind of arrogant and judgmental. I was making a big deal about something that they were doing wrong. And I feel like, oh man, I wish I could go back and do that over again. The opportunities that we squander, that we miss because we're petty, because we're in the flesh, because we're not completely committed to what God wants to do. I remember one boy in particular who I knew him when he was going through school, and he'd graduated from eighth grade, and we didn't have a high school at the time. And he was a neat kid, a lot of fun. And, you know, I remember a few weeks before he ended up dying, I gave him a ride home, and we were talking about music. He was really into rock music, and so we were talking about different musicians and songs, and you know, he showed me a couple of songs that, you know, some Jimi Hendrix songs that he was learning, and we were talking about it, and we had a great time together. But a couple days later, during church, I was patrolling the parking lot at Calvary, and Aaron was out there sitting on the lunch tables making out with this girl, and it made me really mad, and I went out there and I chewed him out. And I told them, this isn't right, and you need to be listening to the Bible study or get off the grounds. And I was real heavy-handed with them. And I thought justifiably so, until the next day I was standing there in the hospital looking at his face swollen to like twice its size because he had snorted some cocaine and he had never done it before. He got it from his sister, took way too much, and went through a plate glass window. And as I stood there watching him die, I thought, man, I wish I had another chance just to say, hey, play me another song. You know, let's talk. I wish I had gone out there and said, you know, made a joke of it and, you know, still, come on into church. But not like that. Not the last time I got to talk to him. We don't know. How many opportunities are we going to have? How many chances are we going to have? Think about people right now that you're not on good terms with. You could be healing that relationship. You can just be reaching out to them in love. Or you can just be in the flesh and just go, no, I want to be mad at them for a little while longer. They need to be punished. They need to understand. I'm telling you, the day is going to come when that opportunity is gone. We can't afford to dink around with our lives and not have that commitment to God that says, I want to do everything that God can do through me. I want to be open to anything that he wants to do in my life. I don't want to limit God because of my flesh. And the life of Samson reminds us of that in graphic detail. A guy who had so much potential, so many opportunities, and he just wasted them. It didn't happen for the most part for him. Mostly he's a great bad example. Let's not live like that. Let's get back to square one, back to our Father's house, and just go, I just want to be committed to the Lord. I remember one time I was talking to a friend of mine, Odin Fong, and we were cleaning the bathrooms. It was like midnight after church, and we were cleaning the women's restroom, which is always the dirtiest one, and it was gross. We were just getting ourselves upset, talking about some things that weren't right in the church, and we were trying to solve the problems of the world. And finally, I just go, you know, doesn't it just drive you nuts? And Odin said, you know, yeah, but he said, I realize I have a race to run. And that hit me so much, I'll never forget it. It's true, we have a race to run. We can't afford to become distracted. We don't have time to hang out with people that we shouldn't be hanging out with, to give up opportunities to make a difference in people's lives. We can't afford to do that. We don't know how much time we have. But we know that with what God has committed to us, if we commit it to him, he can do great things in our lives. Let's pray. Lord, we enjoy reading about Samson. It's a great story. All these stories in the book of Judges are so graphic and so interesting. But God, when we look closer, these guys, we see a disturbing picture because we see ourselves in these stories. We see ourselves in Jephthah making a dumb promise without thinking about it, making a commitment of something that would cost him more than he realized. We think of the Ephraimites in chapter 12 who just tried to jump on the bandwagon of something, let their anger get to them. And Samson in so many ways, so many different situations where he could have made a difference. He could have been a power for healing, but instead he divided and he tore up and he was selfish and he looked to his own gratification and he did what was right in his own eyes instead of maintaining that commitment that he had made to you, that his parents had made to you from before his birth, that he would be set apart and consecrated. You tell us that we are set apart and consecrated. You've called us to that. Lord, bring us back to our Father's house. Remind us of our commitments that we've made. And God, we're sorry for the times this week already when we've become caught up in the flesh, in our anger and selfishness, in our desire to fulfill our fleshly desires. And we've missed opportunities already. We're sorry. But we thank you that you're a patient God, that you still want to work in us. It amazes us, but we're so grateful. God, help us to redeem the time, to make the most of the opportunities, to live our lives completely committed to you and you alone. In Jesus' name, amen.